Hey everybody, this is episode 13 of the Focus Hunting Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dean Tremblay. Dean is the co-host of the Federal Premium's Trigger Effect. Dean and I discuss the bumps and bruises on the road to becoming a successful TV host, and we also touch on the controversy over hunting in Africa. So as always, sit back, turn the rest of this intro up, and enjoy this episode. Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Focus Hunting Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dean Tremblay. This is the second attempt at this podcast. The first go-around I had a recording issue, so we got it all figured out now, and yeah, we're recording. So thanks for coming on again, Dean.
Yeah, no problem at all, Kev.
How's the snow down there?
Well, I'll tell you, last time I talked to you, it was green lawn, and today we really got hammered in Falkland. I don't know about you guys, but we got probably just under a foot.
Yeah, is that right? Yeah, we didn't get a lot here. I'm pretty close to the lake, though. We only got about an inch, but I know my parents, they got about just under a foot. They live in Rock Creek, so yeah, lots of snow. You're in the Falkland area, so how long you been out there?
Actually, I've been here just about coming up on 11 years, but I mean, I haven't really strayed a whole lot from home. I was born and raised in Vernon, and I did all my post-secondary education in Ontario and moved right back.
Kids are all grown up and out of the house, I guess?
You betcha. I still have one of my adult sons living with me. He's heading back to university, but other than that, yeah, I'm an empty nester. I have five kids in total.
Oh, wow. Five. I thought three was a handful. Yeah, cool. So just you and the wifey now, I guess.
Yeah, just me and the wife. Yeah, it's kind of quiet and lots of time on our hands. You don't realize how much time kids take up.
Yeah. Well, I imagine you're pretty busy, but I think everybody already knows who you are, but maybe for the few who don't, can you give us a brief intro to yourself?
Yeah, no problem. I mean, like I said, I'm a British Columbian. I was born and raised in Vernon, BC. Prior to the TV show, I was a career research biologist, and I specialized in ungulate biology and freshwater fisheries, and I spent pretty much the majority of my younger adulthood doing research. I think I can't remember last count, was like 75 or 76 studies that I've conducted throughout British Columbia in those two sectors.
Gotcha. Everybody's aware of your highly successful television career, but being the host of a hunting television show is somewhat ubiquitous to the Tremblay name. Can you tell us who pioneered your family name into television?
Yeah, definitely. It was my grandfather, Smokey Tremblay. He used to have a radio talk show called Smoke in the Country. And he literally did like weekly reports on hunting and fishing back in the 70s and the 80s. He also worked for the Vernon Daily News and did a column as well, talking about hunting and fishing. And he also did some stints on television too. And so as a kid growing up as his grandson, I was very familiar with, many times having to sit quiet in the truck in a clear cut because he connected by radio to, you know, CJIB or CCAL and did his reports and things like that. So it was a normal upgrowing for me. So it wasn't too much of a stretch, for me to eventually get into television.
So I imagine, like you said, you got a lot of opportunity to hunt with Smokey. Was he the biggest hunting mentor growing up, or was that role split with your dad?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it was split to a certain extent. My dad was a very successful businessman for Consumers Glass. And, raising two kids. So, he spent as much time as he could with us. But obviously, as many fathers and mothers can identify with, you got to work. So I definitely spent the majority of my time in the bush with my grandfather. He comes from a long line of hunters. Both his father and grandfather hunted. So a lot of my experience and drive to not just hunt, but to eventually become a biologist came from the influence of my grandfather.
Five kids, you see any of them following in the tradition of hunting host?
I do. And you know what, like, it's funny, like you look at our generation, we kind of didn't really have much of a choice because I mean, we always hunted with our grandfathers and fathers, but nowadays with technology and everything, even with my five kids, not all five of my kids hunt. All five of my kids eat game and they really enjoy the hunting lifestyle, but I've only had about, I would say right now, two solid ones. Both my boys are hunters, especially my oldest boy, Dylan. He's a hardcore hunter. And I actually have my youngest daughter who has started to express an interest in it.
That's cool. Yeah, it's pretty neat when you get to take take your kids out. My kids are, they're right into it. My daughter's right into archery. So hopefully she follows that path. So in your younger years, you did a bit of guiding.
Yeah, it's Kent and I are kind of the opposite of each other. Kent literally did 25 to 30 years of big game guiding all over Canada, dabbled in biology, whereas I was the opposite. I dedicated my life to doing biology and I dabbled a little bit in guiding. Most of my guiding started at a young age with my grandfather. He was a houndsman. So I did a lot of cougar guiding. And then later on, with some of the outfits around here, I did do some mountain goat guiding and mule deer guiding. But unfortunately, I didn't get to do as much guiding as I had hoped because, again, I was a biologist and trying to make money in that avenue.
Yeah, you mentioned Kent. That's your co-host on The Trigger Effect.
Yeah, well, he's originally from Rapid City, Manitoba. He was born and raised there, but he spent the majority of his younger adult years out here because he did guide pretty much exclusively in northern BC, but he did guide the prairies as well too. But he has, he's very well known. He has a lake name for him up there. You know, he's hunted, he's got this meticulous ability of journaling everything. And I think he has like 56 guided sheep kills to his credit. 150.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a hardcore hunter and I have a lot of respect for him in those aspects.
Holy, yeah, that's something else. That's crazy. So where in Ontario did you go to school?
I went to school at Sir Samford Fleming, which is a specialty school known for its natural resource program. It's won all kinds of awards. I did my training in fish and wildlife and as I said, later on in my career, as I got my professional biologist status in BC, I focused in more on ungulate biology, more specifically mule deer. And then I did a lot of freshwater fisheries work as well, too.
Oh, yeah. So what was your first paid job as a biologist?
My first paid job, I worked for Halton Region Conservation Authority in Ontario. And I did creel census work on a whole bunch of reservoirs there. Basically walking around and doing biological measurements on fishermen's catches and, you know, finding out the harvest per unit efforts and things like that. So it was exciting, you know, at the time but I definitely moved up to bigger and better things in my career.
Biology, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I don't see the financial gains in being a biologist a lot, but I see it being a lot more fulfilling where you get to work outside and you get to do a lot of conservation work.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. I mean, a lot of biologists, I think, are definitely underpaid for what they do. And usually if you work within government, you're also underfunded. So it is kind of a thankless job. And also too, it always tends to be you're the scapegoat because when things go wrong, people blame the biologists when they should be blaming the more upper end political managers.
Yeah.
And managers. You know, the biologists, I think, are about the only group I've met that are more passionate about wildlife than hunters.
Yeah, well, maybe our politicians should be listening to the biologists and basing the decisions they make on our wildlife based on science and not based on what's going to get you votes. Growing up, you had a grandfather involved in television. Is that something you always wanted to do as well?
No, actually, I didn't. I originally was going to go the same route as Kent. I wanted to be a big game guide and guide all over the place and everything. But my grandfather had a sit down with me and you know, he came from a guiding background and he looked at me and said, you know what, grandson, I get it. You want to be outdoors, but you're never going to make a living as a guide. You're going to be living paycheck to paycheck. You're going to be underappreciated. And they are. And so he really pushed me. He said, go get an education because he always used to say it's the lightest suitcase you'll carry in life. And he's right. And I'm glad he pushed me in that direction. But no, I had no interest at all, actually, of television. The other reason I became a biologist, I'm a recluse. I like being on my own and I'm not a big, you know, get in front of people, you know, kind of thing. So it's kind of ironic.
Really?
No, I'm not. I enjoy my quiet time. And my favorite thing is sitting on a mountainside all by myself.
Yeah, you'd think that somebody who's on television would always be eager to be in front of people and eager to talk and everything like that. But so why did you decide to get into television?
Well, I'll be honest with you. You know, I worked at fairly high levels as a biologist. I can't knock my career. I mean, not only did I work, you know, provincially, you know, doing on the ground research and stuff like that, but I worked federally. I sat for 6+ years on COSAWIC under the Species at Risk Act, working with some of the top scientists in Canada. And I also sat for almost 5 years as a Canadian delegate on the United Nations Environmental Program under the Convention on Biological Diversity, working with 72 other countries. But the one thing I really saw, and it's kind of exactly what you alluded to, is like, you know, I was doing study after study after study and not seeing things followed. And it frustrated me, and call me a quitter or whatever, but I burnt out when I hit my 40s. It was like banging your head against the wall. You know, the current mule deer situation we're experiencing right now, we blew the whistle on that like literally 25 years ago, you know, saying, look, we're not heading in a good direction with our ungulates. So what ended up happening was, and Kent was hitting the end of his guiding career, because as everybody knows, you know, those mountains are relentless and you can only do it so much. And as he was hitting his 40s, we both kind of looked at each other and said, you know, it's time for a career change. And we wanted to share the outdoor experiences that him and I did every year, and also push the message of conservation and management, because, and it's no slag against anyone, but even in the hunting community, a lot of people don't understand what that really means. You know, it's not just buying your hunting license and contributing to a fund. I mean, conservation and management is a very complex thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our government definitely doesn't have that figured out yet, but hopefully we can all work on that. So starting a new adventure, a new chapter in your life at 40 years old is quite an undertaking. I mean, today, you know, with YouTube, everybody who has a cell phone can go out and take a video of themselves and post it online. And obviously with TV and stuff, there's obviously a process. How did you guys get, you know, from being a couple biologists to having an idea of being on TV to getting on TV? You know, that must be quite the, you know, to me, that's quite the leap. How did you get from one thing to the other?
Honestly, overconfidence and ignorance is probably the best way of putting it.
Those are two characteristics that aren't bad to have in business.
I honestly have to say that Kent and I had no idea what we were jumping into. I think we're probably like 90% of people who watch hunting TV shows look and go, oh, I can do a better job. And we really thought that, you know, and we also thought there wasn't enough messaging in there for conservation management. And we figured, you know, I was a research biologist, went to school for years, Kent did big game guiding in the tough, how hard can it be? And I will tell you that the hunting television show industry is one of the toughest businesses I have ever worked in. And I honestly think you have a better chance of getting struck by lightning than hitting success in this industry. And it's not that the industry is bad. It's just from the outside appearing in, it looks like a massive industry, but it's not. It's actually a very small industry. Everybody knows everybody. And if you don't tie into one of the big, big companies like Vista Outdoors, if you don't get in with those big conglomerate companies that own kind of the top brands, your chances of succeeding are very little. And because everybody has YouTube, everybody is pushing. And so sponsors just get thousands of requests a year. And we had no understanding going into it, Kevin. We really didn't. And in the first 4 years, we self-funded. It was passion. It was our will to want to succeed. And I remember the conversation we had going into our fifth year. Kent and I said that if things don't change, we were going to pull the plug. And we won the lottery. We got lucky.
Yeah, with anything, I think hard work and persistence pays off. But I can see the hunting industry or with the hunting television industry being very clicky, where, you know, if you don't have an in or you don't know somebody that's directly involved, it's going to be a lot harder to get in, with sponsors. So did you guys go approach sponsors first, or did you go approach like a television network first and then they kind of gave you the steps to take? Or how did you find out all the steps involved in getting to television? It's such a big undertaking.
It is huge. And you know, for Kent and I, you know, again, this is where the ignorance part comes in. We thought, you know, hey, we're already hunters and we had dabbled a little bit in videography. So all we got to do is film our hunts. And that's the easy part. Like it honestly is the easy part. And even it's complex, but I'll have to be honest with you. Like it's not as easy as just phoning up sponsors and they just jump at you and say, oh yeah, I'll give you thousands of dollars. I mean, it doesn't happen. At the beginning, we accepted anything. I mean, whether it was product, whether it was a little bit of cash, and that's the thing, it's a little bit of cash. And what people need to understand about this industry is it's very opposite of mainstream television. Mainstream television, you work, you have, you know, certain types of funds and grants you can apply for, and then you put your product out there and networks buy it from you. And you know, depending on how good it is, the more money you make, where you're slotted, the more money you make. In the hunting industry, us as television shows, we have to buy our time with the networks. So whether it's Wild TV, Sportsman's Channel, Outdoor Channel, we have to purchase that time, and it's expensive. Oh. Yeah. That's why sponsors are so important, because they're actually the ones that pay us to promote. And the one thing we had to learn is we're a business. Everybody seems to think television is you know, this thing where hunters just get to go out and do their thing. And that's not true. We're a business. We're promoters. And our job is to promote two things. It's to promote the sponsors and it's to promote the outfitters that are donating to hunts. So that's why we have to promote. Everybody's always like, oh, you guys are product pushers. Well, we have to be because of the way the system is set up. I would actually like to see it go to more like syndicated television, because now you have to produce a high quality product that networks are interested in buying, and you don't have to focus on you know, sponsoring, right? Because, and it's not that the sponsoring is a bad thing, but it's just the problem is it takes away from the quality entertainment and good hunting television, you know, and it puts it more to where we have no choice but to promote you know, products throughout the show. Because if you don't do it, there's a million other people out there willing to do it. And it's the same thing with outfitters. You know, when they contact us, they're donating a $6,000-$7,000 hunt to get their 30 minutes of advertising. So we got to promote them. And that's the way the industry works.
Yeah. So how much influence does your sponsors have on your hunts? Do they give you a list and say, this is what we want to see from you guys, or this is how many hunts we want to see from you guys, or, you know, and then you also, I imagine you have multiple sponsors. Must be a lot of work juggling everybody and keeping everybody happy.
Well, it is to a certain extent. And that's why, like, if you notice on television, you know, you have archery shows or you have hunting, you know, rifle shows or crossbow shows, because the problem is if you start taking on sponsors like, you know, archery sponsors and also rifle sponsors, now all of a sudden you can only offer them maybe 6 episodes a year as opposed to 13. So like for Kent and I, because of our sponsors, that's why we rifle hunt. A lot of people say, why don't you archery hunt more? Well, because Federal and Savage and Bushnell are our sponsors and they're all rifle related. So we got to use rifle, you know, because they do get mad. Now, for as far as input, at the beginning when we were a young show, they had quite a bit of an input, but now that we're almost 10 years old and, you know, we've got the industry figured out, we get a lot more freedom now because they trust us, right? And they know that we're going to promote the right things. But it is business, Kevin. So, you know, for us to just plan our season ourselves and say, screw everybody else, you know, wouldn't be very good business. So we always have the courtesy of our big sponsors. We phone them up and say, hey guys, what do you want to promote this year? What are you looking at? Is there any special requests? And we follow through with those things because, again, our client is them. So we've got to make sure we're doing our job and giving them what they want.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that the guide outfitters, they offer you guys hunts. Now, do you guys take every guide that will offer you a hunt? Or do you have a certain amount of guides that you work for or that you've worked with in the past that you like to stay with? How does that process work? How do you pick the guides that you hunt with through the year?
Yeah, I mean, we like to try sticking with diversity for the fan base because, again, the other 50% is entertaining people. So we like to make sure Kent and I are kind of flexing into all kinds of aspects of hunting, you know, to show people something different so that they're, you know, they're not getting bored with just whitetail episodes or just turkey episodes. So that's one thing. But for as far as who we work with, we're very careful who we work with. We do get contacted a lot by outfitters offering stuff. But you got to remember this industry, again, as promoters, reputation is everything. And so, you know, as everybody knows, in any industry, there's good outfitters out there and there's bad outfitters out there. So we do our research on them. There is some outfitters that we continue to work with because they're just fantastic people and good business people. And, you know, they understand the industry. But, you know, we don't have a lot of return outfitters because, again, we're trying to keep the show diverse.
Now, you guys, you book your outfitters. How far in advance do you have to book these? Like, how far in advance are you guys booking your hunts for your episodes?
Yeah, minimum for us is 1 year. We prefer to book out 2 years ahead. And again, it's because of logistics. With Kent's extensive background in outfitting, Kent's responsibility is the outfitters. He is the one that researches into them. He's the initial contact. We have outfitter agreements, legal contracts we sign for every episode that we do. He's responsible for those components. Once Kent signs up an outfitter and that gets locked into our schedule, then it gets turned over to Denise, who's our logistics person. And her job is she does all the research into the locations. She books accommodation, food, any fees or permits that we require to get into countries, all the hunting licenses, everything like that. She does all logistics for the show. So when that time rolls around, Kent and I have an itinerary set out. We know exactly what we're doing because when we start traveling, our job now is to think of the camera work and to think of the hunt, because this isn't like regular TV where you can reel it back. You know, you got to have your mind in the game, because thousands of dollars rely on the decisions we make in the field on those hunts.
Saying a year in advance. So for 2020, you guys would have been scheduling your episodes and booking your hunts in 2019. That must have been quite the challenge for you this year with COVID. Yeah.
It was a nightmare, actually, because as you know, COVID came on quick. And then, of course, the travel bans came on quick. And, you know, we, even though we produce 13 episodes a year, which is considered a full-time show, we film between 15 to 18 hunts a year because it is hunting. Nothing's a guarantee. And we have hunts fail every year, even with outfitters. For us, we went from we had 16 hunts fully booked for this season coming up. And when COVID hit, we lost pretty much all of them. I think we dropped down to like 3 or 4 secured hunts. It was a nightmare. And the problem is the networks don't care, because we have a contract with the networks. So they want their 13 episodes. And so we went into scramble mode. And Kent and I made the decision that we were only going to hunt Western Canada. And the reason was is because we could drive to it and be responsible, and also prevent each other from exposing outfitters to COVID. And we had to pull in some favors. We phoned some of our Western Canada outfitters and said, hey, look at guys, like, you know, we know times are tough for you, times are tough for us. You might as well advertise, and can you bail us out? And I have to really take my hats off to our outfitters and the do-it-yourself hunts, because we pulled the season off. Well, barely. We needed 7 episodes in the fall, and we got 7 episodes, and that was it. Like, it was tough, very tough.
Yeah, well, that's good. At least you pulled her off. Yeah, I mean, the guide outfitting industry is certainly taking a hit this year. Hopefully the guys can pull through this. So what about a filming crew? Do you guys use a filming crew, or do you just self-film?
It varies. It varies from hunt to hunt. Certain styles of hunts, like waterfall hunts, you know, we require usually 1 to 2 cameramen. Just because it's lots of action, things coming in from different angles. But for the most part, though, Kent and I actually learned how to do videography ourselves. So when you see Kent in front of the camera, I'm behind the camera, and vice versa. We did it for 2 reasons. One is we talked to a lot of outfitters when we got into the industry, and they said that, you know, one of the extreme costs for them is, you know, they book a TV show to come in, and they show up with like 6-7 people. And, you know, they've got to feed and accommodate all those people. So Ken and I decided that, you know, for the purpose of keeping the cost down, if him and I could learn how to do both of those roles, that it would help that. The second reason we did it is that we did use cameramen on some of our hunts, and the cameraman's the boss. Like, the hunter's not the boss. Yeah, we're in front of the camera, we're keeping the show rolling, but when it comes to pulling the trigger, that is the cameraman's decision. And we learned early on that bringing in somebody, it was easy to train them how to run a camera, but not everybody knows how to hunt, and not everybody knows how to hunt the way Kent and I do. We looked at each other and just said, hey, like, we've been hunting with each other since our 20s and our whole lives. I know him inside out, he knows me inside out, and who better to be a cameraman? So for the most part, when you're watching our show, it's one of us behind the camera. But we do have 2 full-time cameramen that we do work with. And, you know, on big hunts, like, we're going to Namibia coming up here, and Trent Headley is our #1 camera guy. When we go on big, big trips like that, we take him. But you'll still notice the second angle is Kent or I. You know, we still usually always grab a camera.
Okay. So Trent, has he done any hunting before? Is he kind of new? When you take on a cameraman, is that something you look for? Or you say, well, do you have a little bit of hunting background in you?
Yeah, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of videographers out there that are going to be upset at what I'm about to say. But the one thing Kent and I learned on early is that it's easier to teach somebody how to operate a camera than to teach them how to do a lifetime of hunting. So what we did is we actually reached out. Trent Headley is a childhood friend at Kent's, and a lifetime hunter, and his dad was a hunter. And what we found is it's actually easier to teach a lifetime hunter how to film than a videographer how to hunt. So both of our cameramen, the other one's Ryan English, same thing, you know, we've known them a long time, and we taught them how to run the cameras. And again, it's just because they can read us. They can't read us as good as each other, but, you know, they can read us a lot better and read the scenarios. Like, I never have to turn around to Trent and say, stop moving, because he knows not to move. You know, so we're pretty picky on our camera people. Our crew's very tight, And usually it's like one of like four of us that is behind the camera when things are going down.
So when you and Trent are filming, it's just the two of you. How do you guys decide who's the shooter for the episode? Do you just draw straws on that, or how's that work?
Yeah, it's, you know, believe it or not, Kent and I, we've grown up together. I know a lot of his bucket list. He knows a lot of my bucket list. So a lot of the times, if it's something I know he's really wanted to get his whole life, that it's not a tough decision. But believe it or not, like, I think after 10 years of doing this and a lifetime of hunting, we don't really get a lot of that whole jealousy thing. And I think also too, the one thing when you take on a TV show, I get as much enjoyment as capturing that, you know, golden shot on the camera as I do pulling the trigger. And so for Kent and I, it's equally as exciting when an animal's killed, whether it's, you know, us actually doing the killing or it's us doing the filming. So we don't, yeah, we've never done rock, paper, scissors, nothing. We just kind of sat down and said, well, you want this? I want that. Okay, yeah, okay. And we just kind of do it. So
camaraderie there, that's good. 10 years in the industry, have you seen the industry change?
You know, the TV industry to me really hasn't changed a whole lot. I think the only difference is when we first got into it, it wasn't as competitive from the hunter's end because, you know, it was expensive to get into. I mean, the cameras were expensive and, you know, editing was expensive. But I think as that's becoming more affordable, there's a lot more people now wanting to get into TV. That's the biggest change, I would say. Now, on the focusing just on the hunting front of that question, I've seen significant change in hunting from when I was a kid to hunting present day. I think when I was a kid, you know, growing up or even in my 20s and my early 30s, there was a lot of camaraderie in hunting, a lot of cooperation. A lot of the focus was on the experience itself and putting wild game in the freezer. It was very family oriented, friend oriented and everything like that. But I think, and I think our industry's partly responsible, I wouldn't even say partly, it's a large part responsible for the shift of hunting becoming egotistical. And, you know, it's now less about the experience and the meat in the freezer and more about the pictures on internet and the size of the animal.
I mean, the grip and grins and, you know, I shot the biggest buck or I shot the biggest bighorn. Yeah, it's definitely changed. I mean, I even, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years with the introduction of cell phones and technology that, yeah, it sure made a shift.
Yeah, and I think, and actually, just as you were talking, I remembered something else and I really want to point this out. But when I look at the hunting industry, when I grew up as a kid, you know, and, you know, even in my young adult years, the one thing I always respected is that the guys and gals that were on TV were professional hunters. I mean, and I mean lifetime hardcore professional hunters. You know, we look back to guys, Primos and the Drury Boys, and, you know, even go back further to people like Brenda Valentine and, I mean, you know, these were guys and gals that spent their entire life. The one thing I've seen a shift in the industry, and I don't like it, I really don't, is, you know, when you're on TV, you're looked up to, regardless of, you know, what you want or don't want. And I see now that it's more a popularity contest on who hunting celebrities are versus being hardcore experienced hunters. And you know what? If I get beat up on that, whatever, I don't care. Because, I mean, to me, hunting has been a profession my whole life. And it's been a highly ethical thing that was pounded into my head by my dad and my grandpa. And, you know, if I'm going to be out there putting myself to people, as with any professional industry, a lawyer, a doctor, whatever, you should be qualified in what you do. That's one shift I don't like in this industry at all, is I've seen some people where I watch their shows and I shake my head because not only are they way off on conservation and management, but they have no understanding of the hunting aspect either. And that is one thing I do want to bring to light.
Yeah. So those are the changes in the industry. How about yourself? Have you changed in the, you know, the 10 years of being on television?
I've gotten old and slow. you know, what I'd have to say, I definitely matured as a hunter. The one thing that putting a camera in front of your face and a crew and putting the focus on the entertainment and the experience and the messaging, it's really taught me to slow down and be careful in what I say, because I do have influence. It's also taught me to really just slow down and enjoy the hunt. I think as a young guy, you know, you see a goat up a mountain and you just want to like rip up there and get it, you know, whereas now I've really learned to just slow down and enjoy all of those moments, regardless how painful they are. And I have to give a lot of credit of that to the camera, because again, it's not about ripping up the mountain. It's about trying to put you as the viewer into our hunt and seeing the pain, seeing the grunt, seeing the sweat, seeing the, you know, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. And then seeing the exhilaration of getting the animal, but then also seeing, you know, the pain of getting off the mountain type thing, you know, whereas before I never really appreciated those things.
Yeah, I somewhat know what you're saying. I think I should bring a camera along with me without any film in it just to enjoy that, because I always seem to be rushing up the mountain still. But, you know, I'm just in my 40s, so maybe in the next few years I'll learn that as well, hopefully. As I noticed as my kids, I started hunting with my kids. My oldest is getting into hunting a lot now, and it's a lot different hunting with him. You get to sit back and actually enjoy the hunt. So when we first spoke, you were busy editing, and now I know you went to film school. Can you tell me a bit about film school?
Yeah, no, you know what? It's kind of funny. Like, a lot of my family looked at me and went like, you know, geez, Dean, you're 52 years old and you're going back to university. But, you know, again, when Kent and I started the show, we were very ignorant and we had no idea what we were getting into. We did have an editor, and the editor did a great job. But the one thing that we saw is, because the editor wasn't on the trip with us, there was key components. It didn't have that feel that we really wanted to, or the experience that we wanted to. And, you know, although the clip cinematically may have looked better for the editor, but for the storytelling, this clip was better. So it forced me in my year two to start learning through self-teaching how to edit. And so from season 2.5 on, all the editing has been me, and I've been getting better and better and better with that journey. But with COVID hitting us and, you know, having this little bit of a lull, I decided to sign up with Yorkton University's Toronto Film School and actually pursue a videography production degree. And so I started that venture about 4 or 5 months ago, and I've been loving it. And I'm learning a lot of stuff, but I'm also learning a lot of the stuff that we learned by self-teaching of, you know, that I think if I would have known it, we would have had a better show in our probably seasons 1 to 4 versus what, you know, we produced back then. So it's been a great adventure though.
Yeah. How long is the process of film school? You've said you'd done 4 to 5 months. Do you have to go, is it reoccurring? You have to go back again? And
yeah, it's 2 years. I have to, well, it's actually 2 years, but I'm doing 2 courses every 3 months. So it's kind of a compressed timeline. So at the end of it, I think I have 20 or 30 course credits that I get out of it in order to achieve my actual my diploma. So I'm going to be doing this all the way until October of 2022.
Oh yeah. Cool. So now you're currently in the editing room. What are you editing?
Right now I'm still finishing off some of the Q1 and Q2 episodes for Sportsman's Channel. And so it's a lot of the hunts that we did this past fall and past spring. And it's a lot. It takes 36 to 40 hours of butt time, you know, to put together just one 22 minute episode.
Wow. About film time. How much film time goes into one 20 minute episode?
You'd be shocked. Usually the rule of thumb in the industry is 10 times the amount of footage, you know, versus what you actually use. But I know for Kent and I, usually at the end of it, we've downloaded anywhere between 150 to 200 gigabytes of footage to produce one episode.
Wow. Wow, that's a lot. Now, the process of editing, you said you do all your own editing. Does that include you do the sound and everything yourself as well? Or is there a sound team you work with? And so when you're done editing, where does it go from there? Like, how does it leave you to getting on television?
Yeah, well, Kent and I own Thunder Boys Productions Incorporated. We are a full in-house editing company. So we do everything in-house. So what you see on TV is basically what Kent and I, you know, film in the field. And then from here, it comes into your production component, and then all the post-production as well too. So all the audio correction, video correction, music, everything like that is all done in-house. Basically, we produce our files, including the attached closed captioning files, and they get uploaded through various FTPs to the United States, to Canada, and whatever digital platforms we have to produce.
Do you just work on your own stuff?
No, we offer full production services. Like for instance, next year, we're going to be working with a hunting show. It's actually a group of girls based out of Ontario that are all huntresses.
Oh, and cool.
We're going to be doing production for them. So they do all the filming, everything like that. But and then it comes into the post-production into our studios, and we put it all together for them. We also have another TV show that we do full production for it. And believe it or not, it's a ghost hunting show. You know, so again, you know,
it was a what?
A ghost hunting show, a paranormal hunting show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we produce that fully, right from front to back. The hosts of the show live out of Kamloops area. We're not in front of the cameras, but we do all of the pre-production, production, and post-production for that as well, too, and it airs on television as well. So
you know, I'm not insinuating that that you're getting old and you need to retire soon or anything, but with film school and Thunder Boys, is that something that you kind of want to eventually, when you do get off the camera, is that something that you want to sort of transition into?
Yeah, I think, and I don't mind you saying that. I mean, I'm 52 years old. I don't hide that from anybody. Definitely my youthful days of tearing after sheep day after day after day is not a reality. I still get up there. It just takes me longer to get up there. But yeah, no, I don't think, you know, Federal's Trigger Effect is my retirement. Kent and I have talked about it for the first time in like 10 years. We did kind of a for ourselves hunt this year, and we forgot how fun it was to just hunt, you know, for ourselves. And, you know, it kind of brought that discussion around. We're not willing to pack in the bag yet. We still have a lot of stuff that we think we need, especially our message of conservation and management. Like we really want to push that, and we're pushing it hard with our conservation connection piece with Lethbridge, and the Safari Club International is now pushing us international with those messages. So I think, you know, we still have 5 to 10 years, probably closer to 5 than 10 left being in front of the camera. But yeah, my retirement plan, you know, because I'm not the kind of guy that I think could just retire. I think I'd go crazy. So I definitely am looking at doing, you know, staying in the hunting industry, but working in behind the scenes to help other young talent come up and get onto TV. And Kent is a taxidermist by trade. And, you know, that's what he's going to do. He's very artistic, you know, being a biologist and a hunter. And so he'll get back into his taxidermy.
Yeah, cool. So you mentioned you guys did a self hunt. Do you get to do a lot of or any hunting where you're not in front of a camera these days?
That literally, it was what it was, is we were filming a gopher episode and we were pushing some new 17 HMRs that came out by Savage. We racked up enough footage in 2 days of shooting. And we had 3 days scheduled. And so Kent and I said, let's go out and just have a day of fun. No cameras, just have a good time. And that's the first episode, believe it or not, or I can't call it an episode, but that is the first hunt Kent and I have gone on since we started the TV show without a camera.
Yeah, well, that's 10 years of, must have been quite different, I imagine, of always being in front of a camera to not being in front of the camera.
It felt very weird. And I know that's going to sound funny, you know, growing up and hunting since I was young, but it felt very weird because you're so used to taking your cues from a cameraman, being aware of your blocking and the angles and, you know, not pulling the trigger until you get the thumbs up. And you know, you have to always constantly think of like, how do you tell the story? You know, what are you going to say? What, you know, what sponsor you're going to push? What outfitter you're hunting with? Whereas we just got to sit down and shoot gophers. And it was, yeah, we had a ball. I mean, we were giggling like two little high school kids. It was awesome.
Yeah, I bet. So how long did it take you to get comfortable in front of a camera? Like, you know, what was it like for you for the first time sitting, you know, like you said, when that red light goes on and you have to tell the story? And I mean, there's a lot to it. So
there is. It was absolutely brutal in the first 2 years. I remember prior to going out and filming our first episode, which was a late season mallard hunt in Saskatchewan. We went out and shot some test footage, and we brought the test footage back just to kind of see what we were like on camera, you know, what we needed to do and everything like that. And I remember, you know, I had friends and family, including my wife, in the room, and we reviewed it. And my wife looked at me and she's just like, this is never going to fly. Like, you suck in front of the camera. Like, you look like this, you know, concrete, you know, man attitude, no emotion, no nothing, right? And so it actually forced Kent and I to start looking into, you know, self-taught again, but, you know, going on YouTube and finding out, like, what do you do to actually, and, you know, everything they say, you have to overact, you know, in order to, because cameras blind you out. And so, you know, your emotions, you have to ramp them up that more. Your, you know, mannerisms, you have to ramp it up as well, too, to really get it across to the viewer. You know, there is an acting component to all of us. Like, am I the Dean Trumbly you see on TV? Heck no. Because if you came to my house and saw that, you'd think I was an idiot, you know, because you'd be like, what is up with this guy? Like, Ritalin, please. So it's just the way it is, right? Like, it was a learning experience. And like I said, you know, Ken and I were super ignorant, Kevin, coming into this. Like, you know, what you see now is basically 10 years of huge mistakes. You know, and learning from those mistakes, it's not just as easy as grabbing a camera and filming it.
No, you know, until the shot, hunting's boring. It's hard to promote, or, you know, it's hard to sell TV because you're just quiet and you're moving slow, or you're moving very quickly where the camera wouldn't be able to keep up to you. Yeah. So to get it where people can watch it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a whole nother ball game. So yeah. You guys, you plan your hunts a year in advance. So being 2021 coming up, you've already got your, you already have season 10 planned. Can we get a teaser for that?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to give you a teaser. So you have to remember, a lot of our hunts from 2020 got bumped into 2021, and 2021 was already booked. So we have a very busy schedule coming up. As a matter of fact, I'll be doing a lynx hunt in northern BC here coming up. On top of that, in end of February, we're going to be heading to Namibia finally. We were supposed to do that this summer. We're going there and we're filming 6 back-to-back episodes that'll be spread out over a few seasons. Mostly plains game. I do finally get to go after a Cape Eland, which I'm really excited about because they're as big as our Canada moose. Like, they're a massive, massive animal. Yeah. Kent took one a couple years ago in South Africa, and I've dreamt about that ever since. We're doing the East Cape in South Africa, which is considered one of the most beautiful parts of Africa as well. We're going to be heading down there. We're going to be going to Newfoundland for moose. We've got potentially Ireland coming up as well too. We're going to be going over there and hunting some species. We have a really exciting season. South Dakota for pheasant. It's going to be an action-packed year.
Yeah, sounds like it. What about looking back? What would you say is your most memorable hunting story?
Memorable hunt, not just including TV, because mine would be not TV.
Absolutely.
My most memorable hunt, even though I'm a hardcore mule deer hunter, you think it's a mule deer story, but it isn't. I'd have to say my extreme memorable hunt that I really am proud of is the first time I did a solo mountain goat hunt down in Sage Creek in the Flathead area of British Columbia. I had shot a few goats prior to that, never been able to breach the 10-inch mark, and I promised myself I'd spend as much time on that draw as I could to find a 10-inch billy. I finally located one and watched him for 2-3 days, and I could see why he was 10 inches, because he was just a mastermind and staying in areas you could get to him, but you couldn't get him. And any goat hunter would know exactly what I'm talking about there. And finally, on the third day, he moved into a bowl that I realized I could get into, and I had to start hiking up in the dark. Got in on him just after lunch, shot him. By the time I boned him, caped him, I can't remember, my pack was just over 100 pounds. It was a ridiculous amount of weight. And then I hiked out, I got back out. It was like 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And I remember, and I know you and I've talked about this, especially in the first talk, but you get to that point where you are mentally broke, you're done.
Absolutely.
And I was physically broke. And I was playing those little games of looking at a rock 30 yards ahead and saying, I got to get there, and that's a win. And then a tree, I got to get there, and that's a win. And I remember by the time I got to my truck, I dropped the tailgate. I swung my pack onto it, kind of let it flop in. I went into the front of my truck and I passed out. I was out cold for like 3-4 hours, like just from physical exhaustion. And I think that's why it's my most memorable hunt. And it was a 10-inch billy, and I was super excited about achieving that goal, but I was actually really proud of how hard I pushed my body to get that goal.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have talked about that. And like I said before too, I hunted the Sage Creek area for goats, and man, it's not easy in there. I did this, you know, same similar story. You get to the truck after a long pack out, and yeah, your bag and everything goes into the back of the truck, and then you're out till morning.
Yeah.
So I'm going to let you go here pretty soon, Dean. I know you got a lot of editing left to do, and unfortunately now you're going to have a little bit of snow removal to work on. So, but is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I just, you know, I think the only thing I could add that is just a message to hunters is we need to unite, you know, and I really want to push that. We need to unite. We need to put all these stupid little contests and ego contests and everything behind us, because it's not just killing us as hunters and as the hunting community, but it's killing our resource. And also to understand conservation and management. You know, if you're taking something from the land, educate yourself on it and give back. And that's not just in the aspect of I buy my hunting license or I'm a member of Rocky Mountain Elk or whatever. I mean, you got to get involved, physically get involved, you know, talk to your biologist, educate yourself, educate others, take a young hunter out And I think that's the biggest thing, because whether we want to believe it or not, our sport, you know, I shouldn't call it sport, our lifestyle is dying. And, yeah, and I even see it in new hunters nowadays. They don't have the same level of knowledge as we did growing up, because we had to learn how to live in the bush. We had to learn how to, you know, orienteer. We had to learn how to live off the land and everything like that. And it's a dying art. And I love it. I love hunting. I can't stress it enough. And I think I just, the message I say to people is, as hunters, we need to unite and we need to preserve our lifestyle. And we need to show how amazing it is to everybody, because it is an amazing thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the term unity is something I definitely hear a lot of lately. It's unfortunate that we have to talk about something, you know, that should be so given. Right now, this lifestyle we all love, as you said, is so fragile. The hunting community has to be very careful how we advocate for hunting moving forward. I know people are going to say, well, I'm not advocating for hunting. I love hunting, and I post those pictures of animals I kill for my buddies. And, you know, I don't give a shit what anyone thinks. But, you know, the unfortunate reality is that hunting is a privilege, not a right in this country. And our privilege to hunt is in the hands of you know, the 85% of the people who don't hunt, you know, the non-hunting community.
Yeah.
And, you know, as our big cities keep growing, so does the number of not only the non-hunting community, but anti-hunters as well. And, you know, if the perception of hunters gets swayed inside the non-hunting community by the anti-hunters, we're going to be in real trouble. So, you know, we have to be really careful how we share our hunting experiences and stories. And, you know, I get it as a hunter. You know, I get the fact that we all want to show off our achievements. And I mean, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone of it. You know, the thing I really have contempt with is the criticism between hunters towards hunters.
Well, and Kevin, the one thing I want to say is I remember it was about 2 years ago, I sat down with an anti-hunter and a hardcore anti-hunter. And my whole goal was not to change their mind, but I wanted to kind of get in their mind. And the one comment that the individual said to me that absolutely destroyed me is I said, you know, why is it that you're after the hunting community so bad? And he's like, well, I don't have to be after the hunting community. He says, the hunting community does a good enough job tearing itself down. I just worry about the other people that are, you know, 90% trying to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I sat and thought, what a sad comment, but it's true.
Yeah,
you
so know, true.
It is true. We tear ourselves down. And Ken, I've taken the perspective of, If it's a legal and ethical hunt, we support it. And what I mean by that is, for instance, I've been to Africa a couple times. After this year, it'd be more than a couple times. I have no interest in shooting a giraffe. No interest at all. That's a personal choice, though. Mm-hmm. If I see somebody shoot a giraffe, I will 100% support them on it, you know? And it's the same thing. I mean, I'm a bow hunter. I'm also a rifle hunter, but I would never bash an archery hunter, you know, because I think they should rifle hunt or vice versa, because again, that's personal choice. And I think that's the problem, is we have too many people pushing personal choice. And yeah, you can even take a controversial subject like high fence hunting, you know, and again, it's legal, you know, and it's ethical if it's done legal, but if it's a personal choice, the individual to not do it, I still would support someone who does do it, because it's a whole part of the industry that, you know, supports people's families and everything like that. And I mean, you can choose to call it hunting, not hunting, whatever. But I think the problem is that when you do that, you know, you're starting to push your personal choices. And that's what's tearing us apart. Because that same person who may do a high fence hunt also may be one of the biggest supporters to conservation and management by donating money and joining, you know. And I think that's the downfall of our industry. I hate to say it. It's we're too busy pushing personal choices instead of supporting hunting. You know, now if it's a poacher, that's a different scenario.
Yeah. You know, there's no place for poaching, but there is a lot of criticism in the hunting community that should definitely stop. And yeah. And you know, Scott Ellis and I talked about it before. It just starts with a conversation. It just starts with everybody talking, sharing their story, and then maybe it'll open up people to seeing their point of view. And yeah, it all begins with just sharing your story and working together.
Educating yourself. You know, because, for instance, when I went to South Africa, what a lot of people don't realize, most of South Africa is high fence operations. But the reason they're high fence is because of poaching, you know, so they have these 50,000, you know, hectare parcels of land that are sectioned off by high fence. And of course, everybody gets against it. But the reality of it is, if that didn't happen, there'd be no animals left, yeah. You know, so it's again, it's educating yourself, right? And it's
Yeah, exactly. Well, there you go. I mean, if you educate yourself to what's really going on, and then you share your story or that story, the educated story and the correct one with other people, then they're going to see, they're going to, you know, my neighbor, we were having a conversation about, and he knows I'm an avid hunter, but we were having a conversation about hunts in Africa, and his perception of the hunts in Africa were so distorted, you know. And then once I explained to him how it really works, he was blown away. He's like, oh, wow, no shit, eh? Wow, I had that all wrong. I just was reading an article, and then I just assumed. I said, yeah, but you got to look who wrote the article.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to it for sure.
Yeah.
So
fake news. Fake news is one of the biggest problems I see within and outside of the hunting community, is people believe this stuff without researching where the information's coming from. And I'm glad you brought up Africa, because what a lot of people don't realize is as short as 50, 60 years ago, the majority of animals in Africa were endangered. And there's one thing that changed that, and it was hunting. Hunting saved the wildlife. And now the populations for the majority of species are the highest they've ever been. Why? Hunting. Hunting is the number one reason. And there's no other reason why hunting has been saved in Africa.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some groups that use it. They use the outfitters as ways of pushing trophy hunting, as they call it, where, you know, there's Americans coming into Africa and they're spending a lot of dollars to harvest these animals. But all that money is going back into the protection of the animals. Also, like you said, for the last 50 years, it used to be endangered, but it's not anymore. And it's all has to do with hunting.
Do I have time for just a little story?
Oh, yeah. You bet, bud.
So we were hunting South Africa, and one of our trackers, his name was Raymond. And Kent and I were curious one night. And so we're sitting around the fire, and we said, let's walk down and talk to Raymond, because he could speak the best English out of our trackers. And we sat down with Raymond. We said, hey, Raymond, what do you think of us Canadians and Americans coming to Africa and hunting? And he says, I love it. And we're like, really? I said, like, don't you miss hunting? And he goes, no. He says, because I am hunting. He said, you're pulling the trigger. I'm hunting. And we laughed because, you know, he is right. But he said, that's not why I like it. And I said, why? And he says, well, Dean, you got to understand. He said, when I was a kid, he says, food was very scarce in Africa. Jobs were very scarce. Poverty was everywhere. And he says, but you come here, and he says, I get to hunt full time. I get paid for it. He says, my wife works for the outfit, and she does all the clothes and laundry and stuff like that. And as everybody may or may not know, but when the meat is shot and harvested, you know, some cuts are taken, so we get to try it, but all of it goes to the villages in the area.
Right. See, yeah, that's a good point too. And, you know, that's one thing I forgot to say, but I did mention that to my neighbor when we had our discussion, is that all that meat, none of it's wasted. It's not like you're just keeping the animal out and leaving it there. Yeah. It all has a purpose.
No. And the locals eat everything, like not just the meat, but I mean, the stomach is tripe, the heart, the gut lining, they use everything. And that's what Raymond said. He said, prior to you, he said, we had starvation and poverty. He said, we were hunting everything into the ground because, you know, we had to feed our families, you know, for the meat, and it was getting tougher and tougher. He says, whereas now, he says, the outfit we were with in South Africa, he says, four of my family have jobs. He said, on top of that, the animals are back more than ever. We still get all the meat, more meat than we normally would get. You know, and he says, I get to hunt full time versus before we were starving and had no money and barely got meat. So I think that's the thing, right? It's like you said, you got to learn to listen and educate yourself and not listen to the fake news that is out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Dean, I want to thanks for coming on the show again. Done this twice. We'll get it out once, but I really appreciate your time. And where can everyone find you if we want to watch you?
Well, right now in both Canada and US, we're on Sportsman's Channel. In Canada, we air five times a week. You can go to our website, which is www.triggereffect.tv, and all of our information's on there. Plus, we're on all social media platforms as well, too.
Okay. Well, that's great. Okay, buddy, I'm going to let you go. I got a snowman to build with my kids, and I know you're busy too. So we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Take care, Cal.
Okay, later. Bye.